Appeals, February 5. We have three oral matters this morning. The first matter is file A23-1881, State of Minnesota versus Arn Frank Hatton. And we do ask counsel to identify yourself for the record when you approach the or begin your comments. We are recording and live streaming the proceeding, and so that's kind of the main reason we want the audio is clear who you are when you're speaking and who you represent. And no other recording of the matter is allowed. And of course, appellant each will have 15 minutes. Appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin when you're ready.
Kent's to the underlying crime and syringe evidence that should have never been admitted and also requires a new trial. For my opening remarks, I am going to focus on the Brady issue because I want to address that head on and I will be brief. I want to focus on what we know. We know that there were two key witnesses in this case, the complainant and the deputy who took the complainant to the hospital after filing or creating a report. We know that they testified as to injuries that complainant suffered. We know that the state did not disclose squad car video that shows the transport of the complainant to the hospital. We know that the evidence does not show what the complainant and the deputy testified to. We know that the jury heard about these injuries. We know that the prosecutor made a big deal out of the injuries in opening and closing. The Supreme Court in Minnesota has concluded that when suppressed evidence could have significantly impeached the state's key witnesses, here, the complainant and the deputy, that the defendant suffers prejudice from that nondisclosure, and that's State v. Hunt, cited at page 17 of our opening brief.
Ms. Bettison, is it correct that the video itself is not part of the record and it wasn't before the district court? So the district court, all the district court had is your client's, if I recall, affidavit about, or maybe it was your affidavit. I don't know if it was an attorney affidavit or your client, but just kind of summarizing what appellant believed to be would show in the video.
So that's correct. Before the post-conviction court,
correct.
The video was not in the record. It had been disclosed at that point to Mr. Hatton's appellate attorney, myself, the post-conviction court, as far as I know, didn't have it, and as far as we can tell, didn't review it.
So I'm going to jump to the third factor, materiality.
Sure.
Given that, for one thing, the party's already kind of, it appears the record already shows the party's already had the, what we might describe as conflicting evidence, the jury had, I should say, had the conflicting evidence of, with her statement and the same report and the deputy's testimony from the next day, I believe it was, or maybe it was 2 days, something like that. And since it doesn't go to an element of the offense, and given that the parties, the information really was out there about whether it happened or not, or how long it would last, that sort of thing, what's the convincing argument, if you have one, of why it would have been material?
Yeah, if I may, Your Honor, it doesn't. You said it doesn't go to an element of the offense.
Correct.
The injuries?
Well, my understanding is that the coercion had to do with simply, maybe it ties in with the argument on kidnapping, but he grabbed her and pulled her into the bedroom and then, of course, committed the sexual assault against her consent, as her will or wishes. I'm not understanding what the potential bruising or biting would go towards that in any event. And then plus, given the fact it seems like the information was out there about whether it happened or not, and then, of course, they made a credibility determination.
So I understand your question really to just be the third prong of the Brady analysis met, which is prejudice. And we really focus our opening brief, pages 17 through 19, on the prejudice element. We firmly believe that prejudice has been met it's been overmet. With State v. Hunt, we know that if
Just to clarify, I guess I was concerned about the materiality. It has to be material, correct?
It does have to be material. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I was premising my question, kind of leading into why would it be material?
Yes, it's material because injury, there was testimony about fear, about what was going to happen to the complainant, what was going to happen if she tried to leave the room, and that fear was tied to these injuries that she was suffering. And, you know, let's be honest about the allegations of the biting. I mean, these are disturbing allegations. Biting is, it's really shocks the conscience of that happening to someone while this is, you know, allegedly going on. And so these injuries that she was experiencing caused her to continue to fear and not want to leave the room and not want to try to even get up out of the bedroom and leave. So that's how they're material. And, you know, we do address the materiality, you know, on page 14 of the brief, but I think there can be no disputing that these injuries and her testimony about her fear and its relation to the injuries go to coercion. Now, the post-conviction court said, well, you can prove coercion, you know, it doesn't have to be with injury, but it certainly has to do with fear. She's coerced to staying, to not leaving, and that doesn't have to be tied to an injury, but she testified about her fear as it related to these injuries.
If this evidence only goes to impeachment, is there still a Brady violation?
Yes, there is, but we think it could be exculpatory as well. But yes, if it's not a and, exculpatory and, as we understand it, it's or. And we know that with State v. Hunt, and we also know that with the U.S. Supreme Court case, Kyles v. Whitley, which we discuss at page 18 of our brief, that the court noted that the withheld evidence in that case went to the essence of the state's case, and these injuries or the complainant's discussion of the injuries and her fear about being injured more by the appellant goes right to the heart of the coercion in this case.
So I have a follow-up on that. In terms of impeachment, given that the video wasn't filed with the post-conviction petition, all the district court had was the affidavit. And the statement in the affidavit is that the video depicts the victim being transported to a medical center. Her face and neck are visible, but show no injuries or marks. So isn't that information really simply duplicative of what was in the SANE report, which was that skin intact, no bite wounds on face or neck? In other words, you know, what impeachment value would this evidence have beyond the impeachment value of the SANE report?
Well, the SANE report was admitted by stipulation, so there was no witness to talk about what happened at the SANE exam. So all it was a piece of paper that said no bite wounds, skin intact.
But that's all, basically, the affidavit says no injuries or marks. I mean, the court didn't have the video, so how is the court to understand that it would provide something more than the SANE report?
Had the disclosed video had the undisclosed video been disclosed at the time of trial, it certainly would have been allowed to be brought into evidence and not duplicative because it's showing the victim. But as far as the post-conviction court, I mean, there was no analysis done of the video. And that's what an evidentiary hearing would be for. I mean, wouldn't that be where the evidentiary hearing comes in and we play the video? We get to ask the complainant, you know, questions about the injuries. We get to look at the video. We get to ask the deputy, who also testified to seeing all these injuries. So, even if the post-conviction court didn't have the video, it still was required to, under 590.01, do an analysis and accept as true the petitioner at that point, Mr. Hatton, the petitioner's allegations as true. And so an evidentiary hearing would have, at the very least, been required. Our thought on that, if it's helpful for this court, is that we can have the evidentiary hearing, but in the interest of judicial economy, this video, if introduced at a new trial, or had it been introduced, I'm sorry, at the first trial, would have been a very key piece of evidence because it was really the only other evidence to cross-examine and impeach the state's two key witnesses. And if that's not material, and if that's not prejudicial to have that, not disclosed and not put before the jury, I really don't know what Brady violation would be. I mean, this is the epitome of material because of the two witnesses who talked extensively about the bite marks, and we put in that testimony in our reply because the state has suggested, oh, there was no testimony about bite marks. In fact, there were, and we put that in our reply so that it was very clear what the record showed about the testimony about the bite marks.
Ms. Bettison, can I jump you to issue three since you're running short of time already?
Sure.
As to the syringe and drug evidence, am I correct, just to first to clarify kind of a premise to my question, am I correct that the victim did not opine what caused the impairment, whether it was drug or alcohol and what type of drug, assuming which we now know is a drug, but she just simply said that he appeared impaired because he was as a result of his pacing. Am I correct?
That's how we understand it. So she had a perception of impairment, and something of note is that the syringe evidence, 2 days later, as we note, was just field tested for methamphetamine, and it was never sent to, as far as we know, to BCA for confirmation. So this is just really a field test. It's like a preliminary breath test.
But just to clarify, the state's theory, there was no, it was not part of any theory about the cause of the sexual assault. In other words, it was just a statement she made and really had no relevant purpose related to the sexual assault itself.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
given that, and just this kind of leading up to my next question, I'm assuming, therefore, if the court had denied admission of that evidence, there would have been no need for wife to talk about his condition. I think she said that he didn't look impaired, or him to respond to, yes, I use methamphetamine. All of that came in simply because the court allowed the deputy to testify about the syringe and what he found and the pictures related to it.
That's possible. I haven't given much thought to how the wife's testimony would have changed, but I think that,
maybe ask it a different way.
Yeah.
A court would sustain an objection, I assume, to any discussion about drug use, but for the fact that that evidence was allowed to come in.
I think that would be a reasonable way to look at that.
Jumping then to the last prong, your client must indicate that it had a significant effect on the jury's verdict. The respondent points out that the jury did hear that he had four prior felonies. Now, I assume, because that's the more common way to do it under the impeachment requirement, the type of felonies were not identified to the jury. I guess my question to you is, what impact does that have, the fact they had that, on our analysis of whether that caused a significant impact on the jury's verdict?
The convictions?
Yes.
I haven't thought of that, honestly. I guess what it...
Well, then I'll ask a different way.
Yeah.
What's your best argument of how, if we agreed it was improperly admitted, that it significantly affected the jury's verdict?
Well, You know, as we said in our brief, if someone is using methamphetamine, it may be that, again, they might have drawn a connection with, oh, methamphetamine, someone's probably more likely to commit a sex assault or do bad things or act erratically or bite or, you know, cause injuries to someone, as opposed to if they weren't on that. And so we're going to believe that he's, you know, acted in conformity with. And that is specifically why that evidence could not come in, because the jury could have concluded he was acting in conformity with or was just a bad dude for using meth, which, you know, people have their prejudices and biases around that.
Thank you. My time
is up.
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
And counsel for the respondent, when you're ready, you may approach and begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent respondent. I was going to focus today on the Brady question, but I'd like to start with the syringe issue, just since that's fresh. It wasn't just that appellant was pacing that made her think he was on something. She said he was pounding on the door. He kept saying, we need to talk, we need to talk. And then, over the course of 4 hours, to put it indelicately, he was unable to sexually perform. He couldn't stay hard, she said. So all this goes to her perception, and she knows him, that he seems like he's on something. And it
How do you know, counsel, that was there evidence or testimony that do we even know what led to her perception? My understanding is that the reference she made it was in response or a comment related to pacing.
Well,
you're referring to what the record shows and then inferring making an inference, I assume that there were other evidence that would lead to her perception, but did she indicate that?
Well, she said, and I'm going off the statement of facts now in my brief, he came in, he seemed like he was under the influence of something because he was pacing back and forth because he kept saying we needed to talk. Earlier, he'd been pounding on the door. That's why she let him in. So again, it's not just the pacing. It's the entirety of his behavior. And then you have what follows where he holds her for 4 hours and is unable to penetrate her except a little bit, she says.
So what's the relevance of that, though, to the criminal sexual assault and the elements and what the state had to prove?
Well, it goes to her credibility, for one thing, and it goes to maybe why he did this and why it would explain that he couldn't sexually perform even though he kept trying over these 4 hours.
Was there any evidence, or whether expert or otherwise, to connect all those dots to his behavior and his inability to sexually perform?
No, there wasn't. But I don't think you need an expert to explain that people on meth behave erratically. And there wasn't any objection below, oh, this can't come in without an expert. You need some more explanation of this. And I think a critical point here is the objection to the syringe evidence was, I think it's around page 149 of the transcript. That is well after, in opening statement, the wife says he didn't seem like he was high when he came home. So that door had already been opened. It wasn't just because of the syringe evidence, because the defense hadn't even tried to exclude the syringe evidence until after they said that. But really, bottom line here is, he didn't just have 4 prior felonies. He had 4 prior felonies in the last 2 years. So if appellant's concerned, well, because of the meth, they might have thought he was a bad dude, they're probably going to think he's a bad dude because he's got 4 felonies in the past 2 years, and he's on probation at the time this happened. So there's no reasonable possibility here that, oh, they wouldn't have believed the victim but for hearing about this syringe evidence. That's not a close call here. The more interesting question, I think, is the Brady question. And I want to start quickly with the post-conviction hearing issue. And I think maybe the best way to look at this is, what's the prejudice? I mean, this court has the video. It can watch the video. So sending this back...
I don't think the video is in the record. I looked through the record... and I wasn't able to find it. And what we have is the affidavit from counsel describing the video, but it doesn't appear, at least in the appellate record before us, that it was provided to the post-conviction court as part of the petition.
Well, that's a surprise to me, frankly. I thought it was. It should have been. Appellant made a motion to suppress my discussion of the photographs, so we had those submitted to supplement the record. Appellant hasn't made a motion to say you can't talk about what's in the video because it isn't part of the record. So if it isn't, it should be. That certainly could be something we could do along with
well,
the way we got the photographs in.
Well, if it wasn't provided to the post-conviction court, I don't think it's part of the record. It wouldn't be part of the appellate record, so it wouldn't be appropriate to provide it to this court at this time.
Well, but you saw, I think, that I got the record supplemented with photographs that everyone talked about in the post, and the judge saw, but just no one thought to say, hey, let's officially make this part of the record. It'd be the same thing for the video here. And in any event, you wouldn't defer to the judge on the video because you can look at it for yourself. And accepting as true what appellant says about the video, that it doesn't show bike marks, which is that's why you'd have a hearing, so he could prove that. Well, if we're accepting it as true, it still doesn't entitle him to relief because, and I think this is very important, the victim never said that he left bite marks on her face. And anyone who's ever had a pet or a kid who engaged in biting knows you can have bruising or redness from bite marks without leaving, from biting without leaving bite marks. And we're talking now about 24 hours later. So even if there were initially bite marks, she never said, oh, yeah, the bite marks were still there a whole day later. So it doesn't impeach her testimony. Appellant has said, well, the redness in her face proves our case. And I don't understand that at all. I mean, if anything, the redness shows that there was some bruising or irritation to her face.
But isn't that, I mean, it's a pretty lenient standard to get an evidentiary hearing. And so I guess I'm struggling with why that sort of minimum due process wasn't provided here so that the district court would actually review the video and could make some of these findings because I think as Judge Cochran was saying, we're an error correcting court. We generally don't find facts.
Right. And I thought that the video was before the judge and the post-conviction judge watched it and just didn't feel the need to watch it in open court. I mean, the judge makes a reference in her findings to the evidence doesn't support relief here, which would suggest to me that she's watched the video. But even if she hadn't, as long as you can watch it, anything that she found about the video that is different from what you see would be clearly erroneous because you can see the video for yourself and you don't defer to clearly erroneous findings of fact. So if we send it back for hearing, that sure, the judge could watch it and say, yep, you don't get a Brady reversal, and then we'd be right back where we are now. I mean, you wouldn't defer to the judge on what the video clearly does or doesn't show.
Judge's findings, sufficient for a review here even? I mean, there's one sentence basically that says, regarding the squad car recording, the petitioner focuses on the lack of disclosure but makes an insufficient showing the evidence is exculpatory or impeaching, but then goes on to talk about how the petitioner and state were able to question witnesses about physical marks on the victim, and perhaps because the video wasn't before the court doesn't really explain, at least in my view, why the showing was insufficient that it is either exculpatory or impeaching.
Let me say two things in response to that. First of all, even if the judge had made factual findings, you would not defer to them because the video is available for you to watch, right? If it isn't, it will be and should be. And you wouldn't say, well, the judge sees this, we see this, we're going to defer to what the judge sees when you can watch it for yourself. And the critical thing on post-conviction is you have to accept the defense's allegations as true. And we are accepting as true here that in this squad video, you can't see bite marks. But the victim never said there were bite marks the next day. And we also have the same photographs now that show the injury to her neck and a measurement of it. So if there was a retrial, it's doubtful they'd even use the squad video because if you say squad video proves no injuries, well, we got photographs that prove injuries. And the defense here is consent. So really the argument here is going to be and was she consented to this. And biting is not inconsistent with vigorous but consensual sexual activity. And that's really the only defense he has here, is she agreed to this 4 hours. She says no. We've got injuries in the same photos. And I think another critical point here is the jury acquitted.
We have the same report, which is basically, or seems to be consistent with what the the description of the video.
I think that's a key point here, too, is that the video would just be redundant to that. Both say no bite marks. She never said there were bite marks the next day. But you do have the photographs now because in response to the appellant's motion to strike, I did a motion, or the county attorney did a motion to the district court. The record has now been supplemented with these photos that everyone talked about, so they are now part of the record. If there was a retrial, obviously they would be usable. So there's no point in having a new trial here where,
but,
you know.
Well, could you respond to appellant's argument that, this additional piece of evidence would reinforce the credibility would provide the jury with additional information upon which to make a credibility determination, and it's important for that reason.
Well, that is ultimately, it has to be the argument here, that the jury would have found her not credible, would have concluded she lied if only it had seen the squad video with redness on her cheeks. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, the best he could do is say, look at the squad video. You can't see any bite marks. Well, we already know there weren't any bite marks from the SANE report. It's cumulative, as you pointed out. And she never said there were bite marks the next day. If you look at appellant's reply brief, bite marks and bruising and redness are not the same thing. I've been very careful with my language here. She talked about bruising. She talked about redness. You can have that from biting without having a bite mark. She never said he left bite marks on my face. The bites resulted in injuries, but injuries and bite marks are not synonymous. And I think a key point here is the jury acquitted on the top two counts here, both of which require injury. So he already got the benefit of the SANE reports not being submitted. First degree requires injury. Second degree requires injury. They acquitted on both of those.
Because I thought the SANE report was before in evidence.
He got the benefit of the SANE photographs not being in front of the jury because the SANE photographs show the injuries. He got a lucky break here because they didn't see the injuries, which they should have.
A question about whether that's even properly before us, the photographs, but anyway.
I don't think there was any more because the district court granted a motion to supplement the record. And that's my response to the motion to strike, and there has never been any appeal or challenge to that. So they are now part of the record. They certainly could be used on a retrial. And so.
But for purposes of Brady and its impact, don't we just look at what the jury saw, not what they didn't see?
Right.
So it wouldn't do us any good, obviously, for that reason, to look at the photos in our analysis. It would play no part.
Well, except to the extent that if appellant had used this squad video at trial to say, look, this proves there's no bite marks on her face. Well, A, we already know that from the SANE report, and B, that opens the door then to photographs showing there are marks on her face. I mean, this court is well aware that oftentimes there's character evidence or other evidence that doesn't come in unless the defense opens the door. But a judge's refusal to submit evidence, to allow evidence, is not a license to deceive. And that's why here the judge said in the pretrial rulings, you can't insinuate that there's no photographs. You can just ask the deputy, did you take any photographs? But you can't try and trick the jury into thinking there aren't any photographs because there are. The state just can't use them because of the late disclosure. But the state could use them in a new trial. And in the first trial, they would have opened the door to those photographs if they had said, ha-ha, look at the squad video. She's red in the face, yes, but there's no bite marks. And I think the other critical...
So under what... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Your statement about her being red in the face assumes that that's what's on the video, but the video is not in the record. So we can't consider that in our argument. In our analysis.
Well, this is the first I've heard an argument that the video can't be considered by this court. Appellants never made that argument. Appellant did a motion to strike the photographs.
We have the video, so.
Okay, well, I believe you should. I believe the post-conviction court did, and certainly there could be another motion to supplement the record, just like there was with the photographs.
But isn't that like the photographs? If the judge didn't have it, and we're reviewing the post-conviction court didn't have it, it's similar to the pictures that the jury didn't have. How would any of that be proper for us to consider?
Well, I mean, I guess you could remand for a post-conviction hearing to make sure the judge watches the video. The problem is you wouldn't defer to what the judge says about the video because then you would watch it yourself. So on post-conviction, you have to assume that everything the defense says is true.
I guess I'm confused by that because I believe under the abuse of discretion standard, we would defer to the findings of the district court with respect to the video. I understand your point that we would independently watch the video, but I think to the extent that we would find the video unclear, we would defer to the findings of the district court as opposed to independently reviewing it ourselves. I guess I'm not understanding procedurally how we would be allowed to just disregard the findings of the district court with respect to the video.
Well, you would if they were clearly erroneous. And if you see the video and it doesn't show what the district court says it shows, then they're clearly erroneous. And the district court, everyone's agreed here, I believe in the reply brief, that the video shows redness of the cheeks. Appellant says, aha, the redness in the cheeks proves that we should get a new trial. But no one's disputing that that's what the video shows, redness in her cheeks. And appellant never claimed to have witnesses to call at a post-conviction hearing to say, well, that redness was there 2 days before. I mean, the redness is also in the same photograph. So we know the redness wasn't just because she was in a cold squad car, which she was in for 40 minutes, so presumably it wasn't freezing cold the whole time. So appellants never claimed, oh, here's more facts that this court doesn't have the benefit of because there was no post-conviction hearing. Again, appellants never said, state, you can't even talk about the video the way you can't talk about the photographs because it's not part of the record. If they had said that, we would have supplemented the record with the video the same way we supplemented the record with the photographs. I think I've been talking very fast, and I think I've said everything I wanted to say, and I'm almost out of time anyway. So if the court has any questions on the kidnapping issue, I'm happy to answer those. Otherwise, we'll leave those to our brief, obviously. And I guess my final pitch here is, at most, this court could remand for a post-conviction hearing. But there's no basis on this record for saying this video evidence is so strong that the jury would have thought the victim was lying if only they had seen it. So the victim should have to endure a new trial. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
The state has a disclosure problem in this case. They didn't disclose the video, and they late disclosed the photographs. The photographs were properly excluded right before trial started. The fact of the matter is that Mr. Hatton has not had the benefit of showing this video to the jury, which was his right. Now, the state wants to make, you know, our questioning about the complainant's, you know, testimony and, you know, allegations like a moral or ethical issue. It's not a moral or ethical issue. It's a constitutional issue. We get to test the credibility of both witnesses, and we get to do it with a video that we never had access to. And that video is very different than a sane report that has one line that said, or two, three lines, skin intact, no bite wounds. This is a constitutional issue, and asking, playing the video for the jury and asking the complainant and the deputy, where are the injuries? Where are the, you know, the bruising? Where are the red marks? Is this red, are your red cheeks, the symmetrical flushing, is it rosacea? Is it because it's cold? None of those questions, none of those lines of inquiry, Mr. Hatton was able to ask. And it is material because it is related to coercion and the injury, however coercion was going to be proved. And it's related to this testimony of this complainant. Are they going to believe her on the injuries? Are they going to believe that she was afraid? And again, not a moral or ethical issue in us asking, what is the complainant testifying to? We get to test credibility, and we never got to. Mr. Hatton never got to. I just want to make a comment about bite marks. The state is very adamant that she never said bite marks. Now, let's be clear. Bite marks, we're not talking about the perfect bite marks that you see or you think of, you know, with the symmetrical showing of an actual mouth imprint. We're talking bruising red marks that are from biting. And we detail the testimony of both the complainant and the deputy on page 3 of our reply, so we're all clear about what these injuries are that are being complained of. And the video shows just a redness in the cheeks, whether it was a cold weather, rosacea, health thing, or, you know, we get to ask that, and we never got to ask that, or Mr. Hatton never did, I should say. I want to say
about the syringe evidence. The state argues that wife's testimony opened the door to that evidence, because wife testified that the defendant did not appear to be under the influence when, or I don't remember her exact words, but something to that effect. So can you address the argument about that testimony opening the door to that, the syringe evidence?
So I would have to look back at the record, and I would be happy to supplement or to provide an additional letter brief on this. But it's my understanding that the syringe photographs came in the state's case in chief, and that the wife was a defense witness. And so the state opened the door with the syringe photographs, and this was basically a rebuttal. And so I don't see how that's opening the door to then, you know, explain. You know, there's probably at that point there, you know, probably wanted to have some explanation, because this evidence, which had no connection to any element of the charged crimes, was being discussed and shown to the jury and prejudicing Mr. Hatton.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Her time's almost up, but can I ask a question about the kidnapping issue? I have a question with regard to the kidnapping question, and that is, we do have some pre-Smith and Welch precedential case law from our court that would indicate that where the complainant is held for a particularly long period of time, and there's multiple assaults, that is sufficient to allow for the separate kidnapping charge. And I'm wondering if you think those precedential cases survive Smith and Welch, or if those have been overruled by those decisions. That purely the length of time, and I guess I'm pointing specifically to the State v. Butterfield case, where the person was held for 19 hours and assaulted multiple times over the course of those 19 hours. Do you think that those precedential cases survive Smith and Welch?
Whether they survive Smith and Welch?
Do you think that the Supreme Court would decide those cases similarly based on the decisions in Smith and Welch?
You know, I think 19 hours is a very different situation than, you know, what I would, consider a CSC, like a shorter time period. I think that the time period is really a red herring here. I know that the state wants to call this the four-hour kidnapping, when actually it was, an incident that lasted for a period of time, a few hours, admittedly, but that the kidnapping was incidental to, right? And so I think this time frame is really, 19 hours is a very big difference compared to, like, the recent Jonas case that came out on December 23rd from this court, not this panel, but Your Honor wrote that. I think the same analysis that happened in Jonas happens here. So I don't know if I fully answered your question, but no. I do think that time frame, the four-hour kidnapping, as the state likes to call it, that's not what this is. This has to do the same analysis as Jonas. And
you would agree, though, that this case is factually different than Jonas?
I would argue that it's very, very similar. The act in Jonas seemed to go on. It wasn't.
Well, in Jonas, the victims' hands were bound behind her back and then released she was released.
And then she was bound again.
But there was a period of time where she was released. She wasn't confined during the entire time that she was with the defendant. She was able to go upstairs, get a glass of water, could have left the house at that time. So came back down, they sat on the couch for a while. So I think it is factually different. I understand your argument that the same legal analysis should apply, but factually, we don't have the sort of break, similar type break or binding.
Right. I think, though, after the cat came in and they stopped, the sexual assault stopped in Jonas, that it then later resumed after there was this break in the action. If I recall the Jonas facts correctly, there was a break.
There was a break, but I don't think we have the same sort of break situation here. Maybe correct me if I'm wrong in your view.
I think there was some breaks. There were some phone calls.
Wasn't she in the bedroom?
She was in her bedroom.
Yeah. So yes. I think that is different.
Thank you. My time is up.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions, your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue an order within 90 days. Have a good day.